old, a real old farmhouse.
That was sort of near here, Park Farm, was it?
Or yes, you can't see it. It isn't far, really.
A biggish old sort of farmhouse.
Yes, rambling old farmhouse. In a little lane, too narrow to take two cars past. It was just a horse and cart. And the times we've run and pushed the pram round the corners to be safe. And of course, when she came back, sometimes she'd come back unexpectedly. She'd come down on the last train from Reading, which landed her at Thatcham Station, or nearly 2.5 to 3/4 miles, perhaps, down after midnight. And she'd come walking all this way by herself. Of course, there were no cars. And Mr. Ashman had a thing about cars. He never had one himself until he was, well, in his 50s, I think. So that it made it very difficult for her. But members of the family were good and helped when they could, but of course it wasn't always possible.
You mean he didn't actually like the idea of
driving? No, he didn't like driving. No, he loved his bicycle. And of course Mrs. Ashman couldn't ride a bicycle. So, she'd left it off, yes, she did, because she told me a glorious story once about how she went on her bicycle when she was quite a girl. And she was going, she'd been to a meeting, young as she was, away up in the hills somewhere. And she had to come back by ferry over one of the locks. And she came down the hill just in time to see the bridge being lifted. And she said, however I got my bicycle onto that, over the water, I don't know, but I did. So that she did ride a bicycle. But walking, of course, was her joy.
Was it really?
Yes. She was... She loved doing things in a big way. Now, I don't mean to say make a fuss and a bother. That wasn't Anna Munro. But she'd suddenly say, let's have a wash-up today. And wash-up we did. I'd help and we'd get through. The children were happy. Another day it would be, I make cake today. Every cake tin was filled, but it was all of the same batch.
I see. So she really did things she devoted her mind to something.
She thought big the whole time, you see. And it was, as I say, the cakes that were made and cooked, all in an oil oven, by the way, that we
you
hadn't
see,
been for weeks.
The thing that interests me, one thing that interests me, is how these women who who've got families to bring up and so on, to run, when housekeeping wasn't all that easy, combine that with public work like
yes.
she did.
Well,
now, in a way, you're the answer to that, aren't you? You made it possible.
Well,
you?
Yes, I suppose so, because I was left and I was trusted. I mean, we wrote and told her when the children both had whooping cough, and they had it badly. And the letter she sent back, Dorothy of Coke. But it was, it's one of the things that I've thought of many times. When I first went there, she said to me, now this is typical of Anna Munro. There was no barrier, whatever you were. I mean, I was a gardener's daughter, quite frankly. And I think Anna Munro's father was a professor. But she said to me, now look, the children have got to call you something. We all have. Would you like us to call you Miss Godwin? That was my maiden name. And I said, no, thank you. I'll have a Christian name. But it was typical of her that I still had a status. If the children, I wanted the children to call me Miss Godwin. They did. And as a matter of fact, they had a helper after the children were grown up. And she was always known by her full name, Miss. So that it's one of the sort of facets of her male
yes,
help.
I understand. Yes.
And also, this is very disjointed.
That's just what I want. This is,
also, when... we went to Aldermaston. The first Labour candidate who put up in this area was a Frank Jakes. He was a signalman, young chap, married, nice. And of course we all turned in to help. Bought an old Ford car for £5 and worked. And the idea was then that she'd be away somewhere else, probably away on her own business, Freedom League, or she may be at another meeting, but if he was anywhere in the district, he was to come back for a meal, and then of course he could, being at Aldermaston Station, he could catch any train that was going on through luggage or anything else. And always she would say, Dorothy, see that they have a good meal. I don't think there's much at home. He's putting money into the cause when it ought to be spent in the home. But it was typical of her.
Mm.
And of course I've always gratitude in my heart for the people I met. I mean, it opened my eyes.
Did it really? How?
Yes. I mean, I met people I would never have met.
So like Mrs. Despard?
Yes. That was a joy to meet her. And that's another little thing. We were doing a march, and we were speaking in Hyde Park. I had 3 minutes all to myself. As one of the younger crowd who came in for the boats at 21. And she came to me afterwards and she said, Dorothy, did you notice Mrs. Despard's feet? And I said, no, I didn't look at her. And I spoke to her. Well, she said, somebody had put her into a pair of lace-up shoes. She always wore sandals. And to see her like that was wrong. And of course, Dr. Knight and... so many of them.
So it broadened out your horizons in a
broadened.
Way?
Broadened. Mm. It opened them up in a way that I never would have. I mean, it's good for the children to say that I was their mother sort of thing, you know, and they're very generous, and I kept in touch, very generous with their praise of the early days, but it cut both ways.
Mm, you got something out of it as well.
Oh, she gave me a life.
Mm.
I mean... the fact that she taught me to speak.
Did she really? How did she do that, actually?
Well, she said to me that it was the way I could help. And I used to go and listen. And finally, I made the sort of draft for the first 3 minutes I had. And, fine, Dorothy, fine. And then she said to me, go on afterward. Now, I'm praising myself. But it was Anna Munro. It was her way to give praise, you know where. She said, you know, you've the art of arousing people's sympathy. It's innate in you and you draw it out. You'll make a fine speaker. But that was her praise. I don't say that for myself.
No, I quite understand. It's a way of teaching you in a way.
Yes.
It's to encourage
her,
you.
And it was her praise.
Mm.
And of course she... she worked.
Did she actually tell you about techniques of speaking at all? I mean, how to project your voice and things like that?
No.
Or maybe you didn't
know
to be taught, didn't you?
Well, she said I had a very good speaking voice, but apart from that, it was the matter, I think, that...
Yes.
And, of course, I went with her on these Labour meetings round, indoors and outdoors sort of thing. But she was generosity herself, and as far as she could... Because I think she had to, and this is between us, I think she had very much to supplement the income. Anything extra, I think it was Anna's, the children's clothes and that sort of thing.
Is it surprising? They only really became fairly well off after the war, well...
After the Second
War. Yes, after
the
Second War, really,
didn't
they? Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And it was quite tight before then, wasn't it? And also
well,
he had a
shoemaker shop in Thatcham, you see, that's where... And the joke of it all is that he listened to her speaking on Boats for Women, the first batch, and he wrote to her, he signed himself Sydney, and she said the letter lay there for some weeks, and she thought she met with a crowd of Ashmans, the girls and whatever, because he was one of the big family. And also, she made several friends, lifelong friends here in the district. And she had this letter and it was signed Sydney. And Mr. Ashman's writing wasn't very masculine, curiously enough. He had a nice hand. And she assumed it was one of the girls. And she wrote back and that's how it started. But
he wasn't well off to start off with and he took a long time to build up the money.
It all started off, and here I'm digressing again. Mr. Street, he was a young RAF pilot, very, very young, in the First World War, and he'd been a traveller in boots and shoes from a Northampton firm, met Mr. Ashman, and I don't know whether he decided that they'd do this sort of, try and do this transport business or something, or amalgamate in the shoe business, I don't know. But he came, and one of Mr. Ashman's sisters had married, during the war, a Cornishman who was in the army. And when it came to, Mabel didn't want to go back to Cornwall to live. She wanted to live here in Thatcham. So they put their money in a lorry, which they bought from the depot that was made at Slough after the First World War. And that's how DRDS started.
It really started from scratch.
Oh, it did absolutely. Mm. This one lorry, which Mr. Pengelly drove, and of course it built up, and then with the mills at Thatcham it was a tremendous help. But I think there that Mr. Ashman had to go very carefully, because they had no room for any labour.
But also he had the rather old-fashioned attitude, didn't he, that you give sort of, say, £5 housekeeping money to your wife and that's it, you know, you don't, it doesn't increase, do you know what I mean?
Yes, I know, and oftentimes she didn't get the housekeeping
money. Didn't she really?
No. I know when she was away, I knew that I wouldn't get any money, whether it was 6 weeks or 2 months, until she came back, you see.
Why was that, actually?
He just sort of, well, I oughtn't to say this, but I think his family, you see, he'd a lot of unmarried sisters.
He wasn't used to controlling.
And I think they came in and they wanted new clothes, and they had new clothes. And when Anna came back, well, there was nothing for her to get. I think she had to work, and of course she wrote, as you know, different articles.
Journalism sort of thing.
Yes, she did a whole lot. That's one thing I remember, that when she was away, we didn't dare burn a piece of paper. They were all stacked out in the old dairy. And when Anna came home for the first week, you couldn't get into the sitting room because of the papers. She'd go through them all, and they were all every shape and type. And long, long since I'd been married, they wouldn't let her have nobody would let her have a Tory paper, you know, one that was a monthly letter, I think they wrote for Miss. And she couldn't get hold of one, and I used to get it and send it to
But you became, in a way, a sort of political friend, in a way, did you, as well? I mean, you were in the movement with her.
With her, oh,
the
yes.
The Labour movement.
Yes, as I was, of course, in the younger branch of the... But the... She was heart and soul in whatever she was committed to. I mean, if she was wanted to speak up in Scotland, she was away, and they'd make her a tour round, and she'd take this tour, and then she'd come back, and she'd somebody would say, children told her that she was very teetotal. Absolutely. And she was very interested in the little white ribboners, which is a juvenile duality, and every year they would bring these youngsters all up to Park Farm, and we'd have a glorious picnic. She gave the whole lot, and there were no end. And curiously enough, when I was at Don's memorial service the other day, I met some of the children that I knew, hadn't seen for years. And without exception, it was, Dorothy, do you remember those lovely Park Farm parties? And it was her somehow. Everybody was made welcome.
She liked making people, enabling people to enjoy themselves. Did she? She enjoyed.
She did. She had that ability.
Did she?
She had one or two friends. Here again, I think it sort of caused a little bit of difficulty in later years. She had one old lady in particular who came from just outside Edinburgh, I believe.
Was that the poet, you mean?
Oh, no, that's Katie. That's Katie. That's the lady who couldn't bear to see the children running.
That's right. Oh, that's right. Yes. Sorry, I interrupted you.
And glorious tale about her too. She was evidently resting, and she came, and she had a trunk full of dresses. It's one of the jokes still. And she got Mr. Ashman to bring her up two gallon tins of petrol, and she washed a lot of the dresses outside in and flung them over. We were afraid to light matches in the house for weeks after. But, no, this was a Miss Gilmore. Miss Gilmore was she was an elderly lady, and I should imagine didn't enjoy very good health. I think she let her house at certain times and came down. She'd come down, and at first I think she came for a month, then it got that she was there, you know, nearly 6 months of the year, more than that. And she became rather difficult. She was a marvellous seamstress, and she'd do anything, mending, making. She was marvellous like that. But as I say, she came and, well, the general opinion was that she sort of battened on.
Yes, yes, because her father also came, didn't he?
Yes.
And he was going a bit round the bend, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, he was very difficult.
Mm. But so what you're saying is she had people in the house as well as being generous to people in parties and so on.
Mm. Yes, because I can't imagine Miss Gilmore. And yet, in a way, somehow they all contributed. Because I can remember Anna coming back and she said, Dorothy, I've bought a gramophone. And it's been delivered. She bought it in Harrods. And it was one of these sort of very nice shaped gramophones. I could put it, I think I could put the furniture back as it was in those days now. And Chris Gilmore had a marvellous knowledge of music. And the records that were bought with such care, there were none for the children. They were all sort of the good.
Mm.
But I felt that we all learnt. It all helped the general sort of build up of the
house. Yes, it was probably good for the people who came to feel that they were wanted and they had things to do. Contribute.
But that was her gift.
Mm.
And, I don't know, she came, of course, when I was married, and there was the same sort of interest. My husband went to work for Mr. Ashman. The last time she couldn't get out of the car, but she came here. Donald brought her, and he said, go and sit in the car and talk, and he sat here. I think he made himself a cup of coffee and read the paper sort of thing. And we had all the old news over, and the news of the old friends.
She had a lot of energy, did she, would you say? Was that part of
she people? Had that ability. She could go like wildfire when she had something to do. But when she came back, she was exhausted. A day or two in bed, family, nothing meant anything to her. She'd get up, she'd look at the papers, and she'd go back again. She sort of had that ability to sort of recoup. She was an extraordinary woman. And, to me, a very special person.
What did she look like, actually?
Oh, she was a bonny-looking woman. Neither the two. Dawn's got her smile, and Margaret, unfortunately, has lost the twinkle now. But she had her mother's eyes, twinkly eyes. She was a bit dark, and lovely eyes, as I say. And she had the gift of making you feel, I don't know, how can I describe it? There was a graciousness about her that made you feel at home at once. I hope you don't think I'm painting this, but this was as I knew Anna.
No, that's absolutely right.
And, as I say, she was great to know, and I owe her a tremendous debt.
What do you owe her apart from giving you all these contacts and broadening things out for you, do you think?
Well, as you can imagine, I felt that when I went onto the bench, nervous at first, because of course there wasn't the school for magistrates. You went and you sat and you entered straight away, and when you retired, the first case we had to retire on, I was the first to be asked what I thought, with all these people around. And somehow she'd given me that gift. She talked about her experiences, and of course when she got her teeth into anything, she wouldn't let go. She really was, well, like a rat for that. If something she felt was wrong, she'd write it. And of course she gave me that ability. She also gave me the ability of liking and reading good books.
Did she really?
Yes.
How did she do that? Did she?
Well, she had a wonderful library, and of course I was always fond of reading. And as you can imagine, that, well, with just the village library, I hadn't got far. I'm sure she sort of instilled into me, I may have copied her, probably, in her dress. Not, there were the years of difference between us, but she was always, I suppose it was an idea of platform speaking. Her dresses were always loose, very, very tasteful, and she loved grey beyond all colours. She had grey in different shades, mingled sometimes with a pink or a blue, but she really was always beautifully dressed. I don't mean to say an expensive thing, because
no, but she looked nice.
She did. She looked nice. Same with her hats. And she'd buy a hat and perhaps keep it a year before she wore it, but it would turn up with something that she chose and go ahead.
Was she an important person in the local Labour Party? Local Labour Party? Yes.
Oh, yes. You go round and you speak to the, they're dying now, but there are people who remember her well, and she was thought a great deal of, and of course she was a big asset from the speaking side. I mean, she was used, she could do it, and she could take a meeting and she could control it. I remember once going to a meeting in Wokingham. She was speaking, I was too, and I got my bit over towards the beginning, and then she took on, and Mr. Jakes didn't turn up, and the meeting got really rattled, got really nasty, and things flew. But do you know, she kept that under control. She really did. She was marvellous. Of course, she'd had this experience with the suffragists.
Yes. She also, she had a little tact, didn't she, about
her? Oh, yes. She could turn things beautifully. Mm. Oh, yes.
Mm.
Yes, there was a lot about her that was... But at the same time, she could be very stern. I remember Donald once. I think it's the only time she really whipped either of them. But Donald was given 2 pence to buy his glass of milk at school every morning. I don't know if Donald's told you this. He hasn't forgotten it anyway, or he hadn't. And it went on nearly a term, and I noticed he was keeping the drawers of his, where he kept his books and papers and what have you, very tidy in his bedroom. I was, I wonder why on earth he suddenly developed so much time, so that we needn't tidy it. Anyway, I thought, well, I'll have a look, and I did, and in the bottom drawer there were masses of comics. My comics weren't heard of. All to Alder Maston, they were a thing that weren't allowed. And I said, well, I don't know. How shall I tell? And I thought, oh, bother it, I won't. She'll find out sometime, you know. And I didn't. Anyway, she found them. And he'd been buying comics with his dumpences. Now, she really whipped him over that. But it wasn't. It wasn't for the fact that he bought the comics. Was that he told lies through the term. Yes, he'd had his milk. And she said, I've whipped him, Dorothy, that he'll remember that he told me lies. And, well, the family.
He was a bit of a problem, actually, Donald, wasn't he? As a child.
Yes.
A very as I gather, a very attractive child.
Yes. Life was made easy for him. Really? Because, and he was a dear. I mean, his ways. I know when my little daughter was dying, he was qualified, of course. I said to Mrs. Ashman that I would like to find out really what was wrong. We thought it was bronchial pneumonia, and some people said it was TB. And Donald was, he'd taken that as a course, a special course. That's right, because his father had just paid up this extra money for him to take this course, and he suddenly decided he was going to be married at Hillingdon. And of course that upset Father very much indeed, as you can imagine.
Mm.
Anyway, Donald came, and I remember how he was with me then.
He had a lot of charm, really.
Yeah, and of course sympathy. Mm. He did it. That was his part of his mother, the sympathy. But of course, whereas she was rigid, and you couldn't imagine her sort of stepping up. And quite frankly, I've been glad these last months that she was dead.
Yes, I imagine so too. I know the story of all that's been going on. Because she was very upset, wasn't she, by the breakup of his first marriage?
Oh, yes. And yet, you see, Margaret said then, she told me at the wedding, I hadn't met Kay, they were married at Hillingdon. And I'd gone up. And I said to her, how do you get on with Kay and Margaret? Well, put it like this, Dorothy, she said, I suppose she's about the best of the bunch he's brought home. But apparently she and Kay became very firm friends.
Yes, I believe they did, actually.
Yes, and I think Margaret felt, you know, that it was there again, a case of the underdog, and Margaret could fight for her, sort of thing.
Could you tell me how she was with her children? I mean, how was she as a mother? Because it's jolly difficult to combine this public life with being a mother. In fact, in a way, as you said, you were their mother.
She never played with them. With anything at all that would help with their education or with their general knowledge. I mean, the books they had, as you can well imagine, sort of storybooks, perhaps of the general run, but not, you know, the ordinary storybooks that most youngsters have. Anything that they could learn. She was good to them, in a sense, but and she was a good mother for looking after them, that sort of, but one felt that she'd had no, perhaps it was because her own youth was so sort of, I don't know. But she wasn't like some mothers to sort of accept a family and play and bring them up, you know.
She was always a bit distant, was she?
Yes, just a little bit away. I think that's why the youngsters sort of hung, and well, they came back. And, did you know Margaret still does? Donald did, he came to say goodbye before him.
So you had to provide them with the warmth, in a way.
I think so.
She couldn't provide.
I think so. And you see, Mr. Ashman was wrapped up in his job. And of course he was never at home. I mean, he just came home to sleep sometimes at 11, 12 at night and be gone again at 8 in the morning. That they never saw their father, perhaps.
So he wasn't there much either, I see.
Out, and he was...
Bleak,
he was. It was. It really was.
Mm.
I wouldn't say so to the children, but they...
Mm.
They really didn't... And you see, they were stuck up away there. They hadn't the chance to make other friends. They lived a life very much...
Mm.
I used to bring them over here to my parents when animal was away, and bring them for the day, and they came into the family. And Margaret loved my grandfather, and somehow, although with all the aunties and uncles at Thatcham, it didn't seem to have a sort of particularly, yet it was a settled life as far as I go.
It wasn't a family life, particularly, no, really, in a way.
No, the cousins came, but they were much older then and stayed. But
so in a way, I don't want to put it too crudely, but in a way, would you say that Anna Munro combined being a mother with being a public figure, partly by delegating the whole business of being a mother, or a large part of it, to you?
Probably so. This was said when I was at the Donald's service the other day. Stanley Brown, one of the cousins, and of an age with the others, they were all there, as a matter of fact. I saw the whole group again. And he was chatting to me, and he said, you know, I've just been talking to Margaret. I said, have you? And he said, I was talking about you and saying, do you remember, you know, how they used to come up and that I'd get them what they wanted and play with them. And he said, you know, he said, thinking about it, Margaret, she was more like your mother. And she said, well, Donald and I have always reckoned that she was mother. So that I'm not saying anything. They accepted me, of course.
Do you think it worried Anna at all that she wasn't able to be a complete mother, really, in a way? And did she feel there was a conflict at all?
I often wondered why she married Mr. Ashman. I often wonder. Mind you, she was wife to him, she kept his home, but I think there was always a bitterness of this political and this other life. He had to accept the other life because she was fully involved in it when she was married to him. He used to go up to her flat in town. She didn't come down, of course, until they got part from.
So he knew what he was in for, sort of thing.
Well, yes, and he couldn't say anything about that. And, of course, the money, I suppose, counted, I don't know. But he was very, very bitter over the labour business, and in the end she had to take a less active part because it was at a critical stage of the business.
Of course, so it was nationalised, wasn't it? The yes. Transport firm, that, you mean, yes. that was yes. The problem, was it? Yes,
I see. Yes, and of course the fact that the Henrys were true, sort of, were blue, very, very blue, and Mr. Ashman would go down and your wife was speaking at such and such a meeting, and sort of by inference, perhaps more than speech, he felt that he was losing out on business because of her interests, which is
very, very difficult, yes.
True.
I mean, I get the impression that it was a sort of love match between them at the outset, but it went wrong, really, somehow.
Yes, there's no doubt about it. He thought a lot of her at first, but I've often wondered why she did marry him.
You feel that she didn't really need a man's company in a way, do you? I mean, she was independent. Sort
of. Yes, very independent. And her work meant everything to her.
Did it really?
Everything. I mean, when she was off on these tours, starting at Rothsay and going right the way around, you know, for weeks you never got a word out of her. Her notes and papers mustn't be moved. The green room was just kept for her to work in. And then she'd come home and she'd be like somebody totally different. She'd cast it all aside and she'd say, now, we'll do so and so. Sometimes she took the children with her on very rare occasions. Took them back to Scotland to see their relations there, of course. but I don't think they meant many times. I remember once we went to a holiday camp. The children were quite small at Caister. It was run by Mr. Dodd. I don't know how they met up. Through the Labour movement, probably. But that was the only holiday I remember that we all spent, you know, as a family, sort of. He never went to Scotland. I don't think he did.
What sort of man was he, actually? I mean, I got a very vague sort of impression of him. I mean, as you say, he was a lot away in business, at work.
Yes.
But was he, I'm just trying to sort of get you to correct me. Was he a non-entity?
Oh, far from that. Far from that. He was... Now, here again, TRTS was made up of three men. Mr. Ashman could be charming. Donald gets it from both his parents. And he could be diplomatic. He could take that side of the business and mould it. Mr. Street did the mechanical side. He kept the cars on the road and what have you. He became a brother-in-law. And Leslie Forrest, another brother-in-law, was a wizard of figures. And the three of them built TRTS.
What is TRTS, actually?
Well, of course, it's gone now.
Yes.
But it was when it started, Thatcham Road Transport Service.
They
wanted something easily painted on the lorries and something that could be remembered.
Mm.
Yeah. But he was by no means a non-entity.
So he had a bit to handle people.
Oh, he had that ability. He could handle his men.
Mm.
And his
but was he an outgoing man? I mean, I was just really wondering, it must have been a bit tough being married to a woman like Anna Monroe, who's such a strong personality herself. Did he hold his own in any way with her, do you think? Or was he pushed rather into the background in the family?
At times he asserted himself. But generally, he sort of was happy to go his way. See, she wasn't interested in sports of any kind. And Sidney Ashman was very, very keen on cricket. He played in the cricket team. He played football. He loved fishing. He rented his stretch of water in the later years and went fishing. He really was a sportsman. And as such, of course, made his own friends. And they had at one time a very good dramatic society in Thatcham. And because he had a good singing voice, he always took very good parts in that. And it filled his life. It seemed as though he filled his life. She filled his life.
Yeah, so they had really separate spheres,
they did.
You think?
They
yes.
Did.
Yes, that's interesting.
But he seemed content, and she the same. So.
Did, I mean, but the fact that she was away so much didn't lead him to take a larger part in bringing up the family, did it? Because he was away a lot, too.
Oh, he didn't. He was content. I mean, Dorothy said they'd be all right. I often wonder, you know, how I did manage. As there was the lady came into the house and what have you, you know, but when Mrs. Ashman came home, she'd say, well, now, we'll do so-and-so.
But no, we're just talking about how he managed in the house. He really sort of left things to you.
Yes. He'd go in the morning. He became a bit of a fad over his food. He'd have brown bread and butter for his breakfast, three slices. And nuts he loved. He'd have six Brazil nuts
for his breakfast.
That's his breakfast. And when she'd
quite
been
quite a healthy breakfast. Actually.
When she'd been away, she'd come back and she'd bring him Brazil nuts and that sort of thing from Eustace Miles, who kept a food shop in Paddington. I think it was.
Mm.
She'd bring back these things and. He'd go off. Well, then I wouldn't see him perhaps any more until the next morning. He'd just come in and let himself in. Mm. He'd eaten with his friend, his relations in Thatcham. Mm. The girls were there living, and I suppose they just fed him. I don't know. I don't know what arrangement he had. But it was practically I and the children the whole time there. Mm.
What help did they have in the house? I mean, they had somebody under you, did they, to clean?
Oh, yes. They had a Mrs. Haynes who came, and she did all the cleaning. And I know I always... She did start doing... When I was there, she did the washing. But I didn't like the way she washed, so I took over and did the children's washing. I always did that. And I looked after them entirely.
Mm. So you're really the kingpin in the whole thing. Otherwise it would have all split up or...
Well,
you know,
I can't imagine her leaving them. I can't imagine her taking them. I don't know. But I was very happy. And as I say, I was young and we did things together. I mean, sort of Donald... would come home and he made more friends when we got to Aldermaston, and he'd take his bicycle and go, and sometimes he'd be back and sometimes he wouldn't, but it really was a sort of free and easy time they had then. Mark,
was she strict with the children, do you think? I mean...
Oh yes, yes, yes. Very, very keen, of course, on their manners and their behaviour. And she instilled into them, and it was a thing I tried to do with my own children, that they must have time for everybody and to be gracious about it, you know, this same sort of... And I think they still... I know they do. Margaret's still got time for everybody.
Yes. Yes.
And I know Donald had. And that's a gift she gave to both of them. Mm. Yeah, and it was instilled into them that they... It didn't matter who, there was no barrier.
Yes, she wasn't at all... I mean, she's the reverse of snobbish, wasn't she?
Oh, absolutely. She'd no time for... No. And another thing I remember about her is... She had no room for joke. Now, Mr. Ashman, with his sort of business, you know, cricket jokes and football jokes and what have you, he'd come home, but they just fell on deaf ears. She looked blank and he'd shut up. She loved funny tales, but they must be of people. But these sort of ordinary jokes, she had no time at all for.
Mm.
And of course, she had a wealth of tales of her own, of what had happened.
She was very fond of poetry, of course, wasn't she?
Yes.
She liked poetry.
Yes. Yes.
Because one thing I remember Donald telling me was that she had a life of her own, in a sense, in the evenings, because she hardly needed any sleep. And so she'd read by herself late at night.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
And presumably that's when she'd read her poetry and read books and that sort of thing, you know.
She, and as I say, when she was growing, well, the whole house was kept for her to prepare. And as she got older, there's no doubt about it, she'd have much, much more time alone. And that's when she would get her reading, because she had a wealth of books, adventure fair.
Did she, what was she like as a sort of housekeeper? How did she manage the house?
Everything on the big scale. the food cupboard, the stock cupboard, was always full. And yet, she didn't sort of branch out. She wasn't a cook that you, she'd do a special dinner, except on one occasion. When we lived at Aldermaston, people that they bought the house from by the name of Capper. Mr. Capper married a Jessie Brodie. Well, with a name like that, you can imagine. But I don't think Jessie'd ever been to Scotland. Anyway, Anna Munro decided they'd have a real night on December the 31st, January the 1st. And they were invited to a supper. Well, she'd got haggis. Oh, we had the whole thing. I wonder we didn't have a piper. She really did go to town. And I can see Mr. Ashman now. She cut the haggis and bled it. Anna, what on earth's that? And she looked at him, very straight. And she said, it's haggis, dear. Well, thank you, I'll go and have a piece of bread and cheese. So that's how it was sometimes. Very, very difficult. And she also made Scotch pancakes non-stop. Sometimes the family would go up on a Sunday if they knew she was there. They'd all go up and she'd stand literally on the frying, over the frying pan on an oil stove. They had a great big gold, two Beatrice things. And she'd stand and she'd make these Scotch pancakes, a whole batch of them. And of course, five or six people turning up to tea. You can imagine they'd butter them and eat them away from and soup. She loved soup.
Did she? Mm.
She was great on lentil soup. Scotch broth, of course. But she wasn't sort of a fancy cook, you know. She's nothing.
But you feel she liked doing things
she
did.
Oh, she did. She did, yes. Mm. And she used to irritate me beyond words because she'd say sometimes, if you'll take the children so-and-so, or, oh, Don's got to go so-and-so, I'll do the ironing while you're gone. And she'd have the clothes horse and she'd have an old-fashioned iron on top of the stove. She'd get it hot and she'd stand ages over doing a dress for Margaret and then she'd just lay it over the top of the clothes horse and probably put things on top, you know, and it was no good ironing it at all, I remember.
She just wasn't really practical.
No, she wasn't. Same with money. Money was left all over the place. You could have stolen pounds, you know, when she had it, and of course, when she hadn't, it was all collected up.
But she didn't do much of the housework herself, I suppose, did she?
No, she'd just have a fit.
Yes, I mean, you did it, or
the lady, the helper, Mrs. Hayden, she was marvellous, really. Oh, and this old park farm. You had two rooms in the front, and then you went along a narrow passage. And on one side, just to the end of the passage, there was a lovely old china cabinet, where she used the china cabinet, under the stairs. It was a huge place. And Anna bought her china like she did everything else, in quantity, as well as quality, because she was good. She loved sales. She'd spend days at sales, you know, furniture sales. And then there was, on the one side, there was the end of this passage, there was the coal, where the coal was kept. On the other side, there were two dairies. One was used as a larder, and the outside was where we kept all the paper for her to look at when she was home again, and odds and bobs, you know. Then at the back of that, there was a tremendous kitchen, huge kitchen, an old pump that you pump the hands, and then an outer kitchen. It really was an old farmhouse, masses of room wasted. And she suddenly decided that it was an awful chore carrying everything through on a tray from the kitchen into the sitting room for the tea. And she came back with a wagon, trolley, you can see it now, burnished wood and cane around the side. But she made the mistake of buying small wheels and running it along a brick floor, very high. We broke more china in a week, I think, and we were doing 1,200 carrying it on a tray. But she did things.
It sounds as if she had a sort of zest for life, really,
oh,
about
she
knowing
had.
Her, sort of
she
go
had.
About
yes,
her, really.
She had.
Which would sound rather attractive.
Yes. And she'd laugh over anything, you know. She'd say, oh, well, I did it. It's a write-off. And her household linen. She always had plenty. She was thrifty. honesty in that way, you know. To find that,
was she really? Yes. I mean, presumably there weren't many people of her level of education and ability who were prepared to support the labour movement at that time.
Oh no, it was a poor thing here, and I always remember once having a committee meeting, and there were lovely rooms at Friendship Hair, High Wood, and Frenchmen's, and I remember one man. He came and he had the most foul smelling pipe. And he just sat and smoked it the whole time. She never said a word. And I knew how she hated smoke. You know, that sort. Yeah. And I got irritated. But she didn't. She just accepted it. And of course, we opened the windows wide when we got.
How did they treat her? Was she always sort of worshipped by the local people in the labour movement, do you think? I mean,
according to the person.
Yes, I see. Mm.
Some were sort of talked loud and long of their friendship with her. With others, she was accepted.
And she wasn't a sort of great lady in that sphere, particularly.
No. Mm. No, it was a mixed bag.
Mm.
Others felt perhaps she could, I don't know. She couldn't sew. She never, well, she'd cobble, but not sew. And when you had a series of sales of work, you see, if you couldn't hand anything in then, we came to the rescue, and I used to make marmalade and that sort of thing, and that would be a contribution. When she was away, I'd say, well, I'll do so. And, I think it was the sort of up and downness of it that appealed to me.
Mm. She wasn't fussy about the house, really, you see.
Well, when she was going to have the Christmas party, I expect Margaret's told you about the Christmas parties, hasn't she?
No.
Oh, well, the whole family. Whole of Mr. Ashram's family were there. Sometimes, I think once I remember Evana being there, her sister. But they came and they'd have a dinner and then they'd have the Christmas tree and every last person had a gift. And she was getting ready for this all the year. Sale, she'd buy this, that and the other. She'd get it all out and label it and twist it round and turn it round. And for this meeting, the house had to be scoured from top to bottom. Poor Mrs. Haynes used to give her notice in regularly at Christmas time. And she'd go through everything then. Cupboards had to be cleaned, dishes washed, places that people never looked at. And of course, the place really turned up and down. I think Mr. Ashman had 11. I think he was the 11th in his family, you know, the sort of. And they were married and came with their children. And the whole dinner had to be prepared. And one part of the family, Mr. and Mrs. Brown, two children, they had to go to Mr. Brown's side. It was Mrs. Brown who's Mr. Ashman's sister. They had to go for their lunch and they invariably kept everybody else waiting who were invited at 3 o'clock for a sort of tea dinner sort of business. And Mr. Ashman used to get so furious and he used to say, it's all very well, Dorothy, it's all very well. Anna has these big ideas, but we never get a thing for Christmas dinner, do we? She used to make the puddings.
Did she?
And they were lavish like everything else with fruit and what have you. And, well, as I say, she just was a peculiar mixture.
Yes, because it's not a desire to show off at all, is it?
Not at all. It was to make everybody welcome.
Mm, yes. It's
everybody welcome.
Yes, you need to get it right, don't you?
And, of course, in those days, I mean, nearly 50 years ago, quite 50, yes. There wasn't the things, I mean, that children expect now. And the kids would get together afterwards, the youngsters, and they'd change their presents round. Well, anybody else would have been hurt. But I can hear Anna Munro say, well, if you'd rather have each other, that's quite all right. She was, as I say, she never failed anyway, came up with it always. By the way, would you care for a cup of coffee?
That's very nice. If you're going to have one, you know...
She wasn't a religious person.
No, she wasn't.
Neither
really.
Of the children were baptised.
Mm.
I think it's come to them. I think Margaret said that Donald was confirmed.
That's right, she told me that.
Yes.
Yes.
But they were... And Mr. Ashman was... he'd been brought up in a non-conformist background.
Yes.
But he felt, you know, to... Thank you.
I'll hold it.
This came from Rothsay, one of her...
Did it really?
Jaunts, yes. All sorts of things turn up that remind me of her.
Was she interested in your children, actually, did she?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes. Yes. And of course, they both remember her. Jean, the eldest, particularly. And of course, when they found that Jean had this special sort of gift, I suppose, because I couldn't do her job, Mrs. Ashman was very interested.
Was she?
Mm-hmm.
And she actually, did she give you help in sort of arranging for her to go on courses or whatever?
No. She just accepted the fact that Jean went to see her when she came home. And my birthday was never forgotten, or Christmas was always a present. And both with Mr. and Mrs. Ashman, a joint present, and then I had... joke, isn't it? The last year he was alive, I had a parcel come from Peter Dominic in Newbury. I was like, what on earth sending me something from Peter Dominic? Of course, I was like Mrs. Ashman, but he felt it. And when I opened it, he sent me a bottle of whiskey. Now I... But he really was, in those days, poor old chap. I think he must have had a guilty conscience about her, you know? Because after she died, he never went upstairs again.
Didn't he really?
Slept down in the dining room, in a chair with a footstool, and rubbed off. He never went upstairs.
He died after she died?
Yeah.
Didn't realise that?
Oh, yes, he was alive some. She died and she died very suddenly, as you know. And he came over to tell me in the morning. I think Donald brought him. Yes, it was Donald brought him. He couldn't trust himself to drive alone then. And of course he would have liked if I had gone back and taken over housekeeping, but I didn't want that. I had my own home and my own sort of family circle, and
yes.
I used to go over quite a bit and see him, which was what the family wanted me to do. And Margaret said, come whenever you can, but I was glad I wasn't there when Donald broke away and went back to live with his love.
Yes. What about friends? Dr. Knight's a person I don't know much about. Did you see much of Dr. Knight?
Not so much. She lived with her mother and sister, and I think during the years I knew her, she was very tied to the home.
Mm.
Tall, spare, grey-haired, iron-grey-haired lady. And then I was trying to think, there was Miss, and that I cannot remember her name, but she was the sort of housekeeper at the Minerva Club.
Oh, Miss Reeves, you mean?
Miss Reeves.
Oh, sure, yes.
Now, I've been trying to think of Marion Reeves
that's right.
For a day or two since I had your letter.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what was she like? She was
she was a nice person.
Was she? Yeah. I mean, Dr. Knight was rather severe, wasn't she?
Oh, she was.
Remote,
yes.
Sort of,
yes.
Person.
Mm. Yes, very secure in her own life, and she didn't unbend a lot. And then, of course, there was Lillian Lenton. Lillian was a gay lad. She was the organiser. And
she became very eccentric towards the end of her life, didn't she? Lillian
yes,
Lenton,
yes.
Really odd, I think she
yes.
was.
Mrs. Yeah. Schofield Coates, of course, Cotton People. Mrs. George Cadbury.
These people used to come to the house, did they, quite a lot?
No, not a lot. These were people that Mrs. Ashman... I think Mrs. George Cadbury came once to venture for here, but I'm not sure. It was just if there was a big meeting and... because most of the meetings in those days were in London. And she would go up for them. But they were people that I met when I went up.
Yes. Did she continue to have this flat in London then? Or she went to the Minerva
no,
Club, I suppose.
She went to the Minerva Club.
Yes.
And stayed there.
Yes.
Yes. And of course it's... there was another lady that she met on her tour. One of her tours. And she married a fishmonger. And she had a little lass. Time. But we always had, I remember those, she used to send down from time to time boxes of fish. And
I think they'd gone off by the time they arrived, didn't they?
No. They were put on the night train and we got them. Mr. Ashman, I think, picked them up at Thatcham. It was better service then, I think, than we had now.
Sure it would be, yes. Yeah.
And it was, I can remember now those kippers, oh, they were small. Couldn't get them like them now.
Of course, one thing, looking back on that period, people who were socialist or who were Labour in those days were people who lived differently from other people,
yes.
Weren't they? I mean, that is, they did, it wasn't just something you voted for or organised for. You lived a socialist in a way, didn't you?
Yes.
Did you feel that with her, really? In a way, a lot of this entertaining, this generosity, is just part of her political beliefs, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. As I say, there was... I think Mrs. George Cadbury was... I think they were liberal, weren't they?
They were,
they
certainly
were
originally.
Quakers,
I don't know. Yes, they
weren't
were.
They by,
That's right. They were originally.
Most of the
They may be people who go over from Liberal to Labour, but
yes.
I'm not quite sure about that.
I don't think she did. I think she was just, you know, sort of.
We haven't, because one thing we haven't talked about is Anna Monroe's magistrate. I mean, did she?
Oh, yes.
What
of course
did you
she
say
was
about that?
Chosen there again. It was the underdog all the time. That she had a girl who was in difficulty and trouble and had got into trouble. She'd fight for that girl. The sentence would be passed, in all fairness. But she was absolutely marvellous on follow-up. She really was. And...
when you say on follow-up, I mean, you mean she'd go and see the
yes.
people in their homes and things like that?
Ah, yes, and of course if these girls were put away, she was there. I think she did a term on the prison work. I'm not certain about that, when magistrates visit and...
Because she had been in prison herself.
Oh, yes, she had. Took me back to Holloway to show me.
Did she really?
Yeah.
Did she really?
Yeah. Of course, that was part of magistrate's work. You did go round to the various prisons. And I know when... We used to have a little club in Reading, the Reading Magistrates Club. And it joined Newbury. Hungerford, or maybe one or two more. And we used to have an outing every year. And I know the first year I was on, they fixed up that we should go down by coach, Southampton, and across to the Isle of Wight. And then we divided up there where the prisons could be visited. Or I believe there was a probation centre and an approved school. There was a whole list of different parts of the work you could go to. And I remember she came to me and she said, look, we'll go together. But I've been to all these now. If I were you, I'd go to the approved school. Start at the beginning and work it through. And I did. We went to this. It was a Catholic school. She'd been, and I think she knew where she was taking me. Because, or she had a method behind it. I've never forgotten that visit. And it's something that stayed with me through all my days. We were shown round, and the children, we met the boys busy at their work and what have you. And then we were taken into the church. Every pew had something done on the end, either a little bit of brass work or a piece of engraving or carving. Everything in the church was hand done, could be hand done. And the father who was showing us round said that the boys, in the main, all wanted to do something for the church before they left, but they were never forced to go and they were never asked. What was done in there was for the love of the place. And he talked, and you know, I've never forgotten, that was a lesson for me, the way those boys were treated. I've been to a good many approved schools since then, classifying schools and all, but nothing came up to that Catholic school. They really were men who not only had the boys at heart,
they were devoted to,
but who really were bringing out the best in those boys. And my word, they were clever. They really had that.
Because it may be something to do with the fact, presumably, they weren't married, the people running the place, and so they could devote themselves entirely to the place.
And yet, the matron told us while we were at the lunch there, she said they'd had a glorious week. I think she said less than a month ago. One of the boys had got married, one of their old boys. He'd kept in touch and had made a good job of his life. He'd got married and he'd written to say, could they come back there for their honeymoon? That was his home. And he wanted his girl to see his home. Well, of course, they were really, and they spread themselves, as you can imagine. And of course, it was Isle of Wight. I mean, they could go off round. It was quite a nice place. The boy was prepared to pay, I think, you know. It wasn't that he was scrounging. But I've always remembered that visit to that particular classifying.
Her magistrate's work was important to her, was it?
I mean, yes. Yes, she really thought a lot of it. And she worked, of course. I think a lot of them didn't like her because she was such a stickler for the right thing to be done. And he really did believe, you know, tempering justice with mercy.
Yes, I suppose she was unpopular with local surrounding families, really, wasn't she? Because she'd let the side down, in a sense, as a well-to-do, educated woman, going with the other side, you know.
Yes,
I imagine that
probably not. Oh, yes, and she'd know... she'd... no room at all on her side. When I first took the oath, went to Reading, of course. There was a man took it at the same time to sit on Newbury Bench. And, well, as a matter of fact, I can tell you this, you'll have to delete, of course. It was Derek Russell.
Mm.
He was, his father was the lord of the manor of Bucklebury.
Oh, yes. Mm.
And Russell was a solicitor and how-to-do sort of. And she said to me, Dorothy, you watch him. You watch him. She said, it's his way or none at all. And she said, he's no good. She had no room for people who, you know, who sort of did one thing. And
she, you feel that she encouraged you to be a magistrate partly because she wanted to get the balance right,
oh, yes.
Really.
Yes. Oh, that's what it was done. And she had to fight because she got another woman who was also a keen labour worker who lived, Mrs. Cook, who lived at near Aldermaston. And of course they'd worked there in the Beenham Labour Party and what have you. And she told me, she said she'd got Marjorie on and she'd have to let it rest for a year. And of course my children were much smaller then. And she said, you'll be next. And of course she knew I'd be working in Newbury. Well, I think Marjorie Cook, in spite of her beliefs and what have you, she made a marvellous figure of the member of the Reading Town. And I think she was outstanding, although she had no children of her own.
Mm.
She was outstanding in the juvenile court.
Was she? Mm.
I got my bit of victory, if you'd like to call it that, in the domestic courts.
Mm.
That sort of life interested. I don't mean to say the rotten side of it, but. Mm.
But did you, when she said, you know, you're going to be the next, did she prepare you for being a magistrate? Did
no.
she train you? Or
no, and of course I heard nothing more.
Mm.
In all fairness, I heard nothing more until I had the letter from Bennion,
mm.
who was the
man
of the moment, Lord Lieutenant, to say that my name had been accepted. And of course I knew who to thank.
But she didn't sort of train you up in being
no,
a magistrate or anything.
No,
she left it
no.
to you, really. Mm.
She said, well, she said once afterwards, well, she said you were always a matter of fact. And she said, I reckoned you were good material, so that.
Mm.
But I think that she had to fight because two ordinary working women weren't exactly the.
There wouldn't be any problem now, would there?
Oh, no.
Rather reverse.
And I tell you what, the people that were on when I first went on, they were vastly different in the crowd today. I know they were, in the most, they were people who could afford the time and who were hidebound in some ways, yet they were people of principle. And you. I know the clerk who came in. I started with an old man called Whittaker. And he really was a stickler with his magistrate. And you had to know if you weren't going. He had to have notice. And you did not miss your time unless, of course, you had something really desperate that kept you from appearing.
Whereas now they're more free and easy, are they? I mean.
Mr. Parmenter would have a phone call in the morning, I can't come, my so-and-so. And nowadays I understand there's a social side of the magistrature which just wasn't heard of in our days.
What do you mean by social side?
Well, they have their get-togethers.
Oh, I see.
Yes, the man who runs it is a.
Mm.
Is a sort of happy-go-lucky and out-and-about sort of man, and he.
Mm.
But in those days, of course, it was the. And we had to do our visits. I don't know if they do now. I was very, very sorry that Anna Munro was out of it when we had a chance to go to this new prison, which has just been opened near Bisley. I don't know if you know of it.
I don't know.
It's a special prison. It isn't for rehabilitation. It's just to get men used to living together again.
Mm.
Apart from the cell life, and of course it's a new place.
Yeah.
She
was really interested in penal reform, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
I mean, it really
was
an interest.
I was sorry she couldn't go there, but she'd finished, and of course it was.
Mm.
It was such a new venture, and it was so much just for the, you know, the magistrates.
Mm.
I think I was on one of the first groups that went in.
Mm.
But I was sorry she didn't have the chance to see that. She had worked for it.
Did she ever talk about her suffragette days? I mean, was it a big thing with her, or?
Oh, yes.
Mm.
And of course she was very, very... she was very, very keen on the side that... apart from the Pankhurst crowd, who didn't yes. care who they hit or what they hit, sort yeah. of thing.
Mm.
She had the respect for other people's property and that sort of thing, you know, that she... What she did to herself was her own lookout. But...
So she quite often referred back to these
oh,
days,
yes.
would she?
And to the time in prison.
Mm.
Must have been ghastly.
Mm. Oh, terrible.
Really ghastly. Did Margaret show you the photograph?
Which one would that be?
They had a photograph of the prison dress. And of
Not of her in prison dress, no. I haven't seen that.
I thought they had one. I don't know. I may
but the, I mean, she was very anti the Pankhurst, wasn't she? Really?
Oh, yes. Yes, and did she ever... did Margaret tell you about Mrs. Solomon and Daisy? Now, they were friends, but they were keen workers. I don't think they did any public speaking, but they were there all the time to help with hospitality, whatever was wanted. Mrs. Solomon and Daisy. Well, now, Mrs. Solomon had a son. And he married a woman, and they came to live here in Cold Ash, curiously enough. She had one son, and she used to push this son in a pram round to meetings, very much anti the suffragist. A woman's place is in the home, that's where she should be, and so on and so on. You want to hear Anna Monroe's comments on that?
It's very interesting to see what happened after that early period in her life. She had a very interesting early life.
Yes, and of course she was brought up, I mean, Dr. Primer brought her up.
Mm, that's right. Mm.
That household, and that was an exceptionally strange sort of household, I should imagine.
Mm. She was always a Scotswoman, wasn't she?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, no doubt about that. There's nothing to match or come up to Scotland anyway. Yeah.
And she's always, you feel, sort of outside her home country in a way.
Did they tell you, Margaret tell you, of Aunt Agnes?
No.
Well, Aunt Agnes was a member of her father's family, must be. But apparently Agnes married the wrong man. She fell in love with a fisherman. He had a boat or something, I don't know. And she went to live in Leith Walk. I can remember that after all these years. 233 Leith Walk. And of course she was dropped. I don't think the family had any time for Aunt Agnes. But Anna Monroe found her. And she brought her down and she stayed with us. And she was a... Margaret has got a photograph of that, I know. She stayed with us many times and really enjoyed herself. And she was a grand old lady. I could see there again, Mrs. Ashman, you know.
Mm.
She didn't really hold with Anna being away. She should have been a housewife and so on and so on. And she went round the house and put us in order.
Because she was away a lot, wasn't she, from what you described?
Yes, well, of course, I've realised since that it was.
Mm.
It was mostly in the summer months when the people, you see, were on holiday that she'd
yes.
do these tours
mm.
because she'd meet up with them at the various.
Mm. Still, it must have been difficult, especially when transport was... Did you ever see her driving? She did drive, didn't she, in the end? She got a Daimler, didn't she?
Yes, yes.
She trained herself to drive about the age of 50, didn't she?
It didn't last long.
Didn't it?
No.
Mm.
No, because Sydney took her car over, I think. Yes, he did.
Mm. So that got him driving.
Yes,
mm.
yes.
Mm.
And I never saw her cycling, but as I say, she must have done. But she walked.
Did she? Yeah.
Oh, she walked, yes.
Did she have any sort of attitude to diet or food or
nope.
or health or anything? Was she
nope.
one of those health fanatics?
She enjoyed life, and she'd have whatever was put in front of her.
Mm.
She'd have a good breakfast. Unless she developed, and I don't think she did late in life, I think she,
mm.
you know, just lived a perfectly normal life as far as
mm.
diet was concerned.
Because she was a teetotaler, wasn't she? So she was unusual in that.
She was very, very strict.
Donald was very funny. He told me that he used to come in sometimes at night and he'd had a bit of drink, you know.
Yes.
And he said it's very difficult, you know, breathing in at the same time as kissing your mother. Because he didn't want her to...
No, and of course Mr. Ashman used to keep it.
Yes, he had to supply the summer house or something, didn't he?
Well, they had this house built that he used as a sort of a sports centre, had his table tennis and his... I don't know, anyway, it was kept there, hidden behind two. Tea used to chew cold tea leaves. I'm letting secrets out there.
She really does seem to have been a real character.
There's no doubt about it. Yes, there's no doubt about it. But as I say, there was nothing at all sneaky or underhanded with her. You knew where you were.
And she disliked untruth or hypocrisy.
Oh, yes. No room at all for it. No, she really was straightforward. And as I say, it was her nature, I suppose, always did things in this sort of big way. She couldn't go and buy one tin of something.
I suppose it's partly saving time, is it? That, you know, if you're going to spend the time on buying one tin of something, you might as well buy a dozen, but it saves you doing it again.
No. There was a method in her madness, I think, to a certain extent. It seems unfair to say this side of things, but you see, she didn't get housekeeping as such. And the consequence was, she ran accounts at the village baker, Mr. Matthews. She had an account with Pikes, the drapers in the village, and she had an account with the chemist. But the bills were always sent to Mr. Ashman. And when Mr. Ashman was feeling generous, he paid up the grocer, she'd go and she'd get a huge order in his start up again, against the time when she couldn't say.
Pretty extraordinary for a woman like that to be put in that position in a way.
Oh, it was a rotten position.
It's not very, very...
It was a rotten position, and she knew very well that the money was going out, you see, it was going to the family. And she said, well, she was quite frank about it. She said, the only way I can get it, Dorothy.
Yes, that's not right, is it, really?
No.
You feel that the Ashmans really rather sponged on him, do you?
I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did. The unmarried ones. They wanted new clothes and Sydney could provide. And goodness knows how he did it, because, I mean, it was just a little village shoe shop, and he used to do the shoe mending, and then of course his other brother took it over. Oh, and they were harness makers, of course. Did the harness. But I don't think he ever did that side.
Anyway, it developed into the carrying.
Yes, it went into this.
So how long were you there, actually, Mrs. Adams? From the age of 19 till when, actually?
Well, I left to be married. 19. I suppose I was between 19 and 20. Yes, it must be. It was over 9 years.
Was it really? So that would be what? From the First World War?
Just at the end of the First World War.
Till mid-20s?
Yes.
Mid-1920s?
No, it must have been a little while after, because I was married in 29.
So it really was sort of from about 1918 to 1929.
And of course we heard, you know, the marches, and she really did come into it as a, you know, the labour movement at a bad time. And of course she had a first-hand knowledge, travelling as she did, of these various places and the various...
That must have been useful. Yes. What about the garden? Was she at all interested in the garden?
No.
Flowers or natural things?
No. No. She'd cut it. And Mr. Ashman, of course, was very, very interested in his vegetable garden. But, you know, I don't ever remember her picking flowers to bring into the house. We used to have them because I used to do it. But I don't remember her.
Really, it's her meetings, her campaigns.
Yes.
That's the main thing in her life always, really.
Yes, it was.
Even above her husband and her children.
Yes, I think you could say. Mind you, she loved the children in her way dearly.
Mm. Mm.
And she was a good mother in lots of ways. But it was just the second mile sort of business, you know.
Yes, I understand, yes. Yes. That's tremendously helpful. You really have been most helpful. And as I say, I won't, this won't go on, be passed on to anybody else.